And this is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Today, some teachers are facing classrooms where students are stunned by election results. At Tacoma's Lincoln High School, Nathan Bowling is an AP Government and Politics teacher, former State Teacher of the Year. His job is to explain this new era of government to his students. He started doing that yesterday.
Well, I started the class by saying, you were surprised by what happened last night. I was surprised by what happened last night. I promise you that Hillary Clinton was surprised by what happened last night, and honestly, so was Donald Trump. Throughout the year, we've talked about how my classroom is not demographically representative of the nation. My classroom is full of low-income students. My classroom is predominantly students of color. My students live in a blue state and live in an urban area. And so we've talked a lot this year about how our experiences and what we believe about politics, or what they believe about politics more accurately, is not necessarily reflective of the larger nation. And we kind of processed through some demographic data and looking at results and exit polls, where things kind of fell and how things happened that way.
What questions are you getting from students?
Honestly, what I tried to do is I tried to drive the conversation and ask them questions. There's a lot of students who are very upset. I have students who are undocumented or whose parents are undocumented and they suddenly don't feel safe. I have a student who's LGBT and she's very concerned that that she's going to lose the right to marry the partner of her choice. I have some other students who are going through the DACA process, and Trump has said that he's going to end the DACA process, and that's a process that allows undocumented students to get financial aid for college. I have some students who are Muslim, and I think President-elect Trump's feelings about Muslims are pretty well known, and they have concerns about that. And so a lot of it was kind of just basic, like Maslow safety and health concerns going forward.
Do you have any students who are Trump supporters?
I do. I have a couple.
What's that conversation like in the classroom?
So I've tried to always cultivate civility in my classroom. And so I talk to my students that, like, I'm fine if you're a conservative. In fact, I encourage you to be conservative. But I want you to be a David Brooks conservative and not like a Breitbart conservative. I'm not anti-conservative. Like, I'm personally a progressive person. But, like, I'm very well versed in Edmund Burke. And I've read a lot of great conservative writing. And I would much rather that my students be thoughtful, articulate conservatives in that frame. Be more like David Brooks or George Will than be like some of the buffoons that we see online. So I just ask my students that whatever they believe or whatever they think, that they be able to support it with reason and be able to articulate for it in a way that's not attacking other people. And so I try to cultivate civility in my classroom. And it doesn't always happen. Like, there's always emotions. But I feel like the conservative students who I have feel very safe in my classroom.
We're talking a lot about civility. You, in your classroom, you find respect, civility, empathy, listening across both directions?
I don't find it. I demand it. One of the biggest problems this nation has is like a decline in civil discourse. And when a society loses its ability to disagree civilly and loses its ability to have conversations with each other across ideological lines, then we're headed to a dark, terrible place. And so, like, I don't care if my students have conservative views. I don't care if my students have liberal views. I care that their views are based in reason and not emotion.
You said that your students want to know what's going to happen. And your knowledge of government, the curriculum in your government and politics class, has a lot to do with what's actually likely to happen. So what are you teaching about there?
Well, one of the things that I said that's kind of unprecedented is how much control the Republican Party is going to have over government. And honestly, if the Clinton campaign would have made this the primary issue, the election may have turned out differently. When Donald Trump takes over the White House in January, he's going to have a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate, the opportunity to appoint a fifth justice to the Supreme Court, and Republicans are going to control a majority of the governor's mansions and state legislatures. And so that's the conversation we've had in class, is that no president has had that much control since Johnson or maybe FDR. And so we're on the precipice of a Republican New Deal. And so, like, that's the conversation that we had yesterday, talking about what that looks like. What are the policies that they're going to change or want to change? What are the issues they're going to push for?
So this is your subject, Nate. You know, checks and balances, the political system, and you teach this stuff already. How would you say this Trump election is going to change your job as a teacher in the months and years ahead, if at all?
Well, Donald Trump has said that one of his goals is to reduce the Department of Education, I think to like half its size. And one of the major roles that the Department of Education provides in my life and my career is to fund my children's education through the FAFSA process. And so I have questions about like how ed funding is going to go going forward. I don't think that Donald Trump's going to fundamentally alter the work that I do. people who are in the know that education is done at the local level through state policies. And so, like, I live in Washington State, and Washington State reelected Jay Inslee. And so, and so my day to day isn't going to change a lot. I try to emphasize to my students constantly that local politics is actually more impactful and more important than national politics. Arguably, collectively, the state legislatures nationwide have more influence than the president or Congress. And so I don't think my life's going to change a ton, but my students' perception about society is going to change, and my students' sense of safety is going to change, and my students' sense of like what's possible for them is going to change. I have a whole half of my class is female, and a lot of them expected Hillary Clinton to win and expected to be walking around today celebrating the first female president. And now a lot of my students are convinced that America won't vote for a woman. And I'm not sure that Clinton's gender is why she lost or not, but my students believe that. And so that's kind of a hard pill for me to take on their behalf.
Nathan Bowling teaches AP Government and Politics at Lincoln High School in Tacoma. He was Washington State's Teacher of the Year for 2016. So that's how that teacher is speaking to his students. In Richland, Washington, this college senior is wondering what the election means. She grew up in fear of her mother being deported.
My name is Selena Torres Medrano, and I am a student here at WSU Tri-Cities. I also work in the financial aid office. It's just hard. It's impossible to move on and to not be upset about this. It's about putting down the minorities in this country. It's women and gays and undocumented people, Muslims. It is personal. It's people's, it's who they are. It's who we are.
My friends who are teachers who have a lot of Hispanic students are lost. They don't know what to tell their kids because they're showing up and they're scared, and the fear is just so overwhelming, and they're trying to reassure them, but they know that it's bigger than them. Two of my friends. Just got accepted into nursing school, and they're both undocumented, and I know that they're so, the unknown is just real for them. What's going to happen? Are they going to be able to finish their education? When they finish their education, what's after that? I'm very lucky to be documented, but it still pains me. And like I said, all those memories growing up and just being in constant fear, I feel it with everybody. It's just this silent and mutual understanding, you know, that we're here for each other and that we're scared. All these families, they had to get up and go to work and send their kids off to a school that, you know, everywhere, I'm just saying everywhere, I know they're wondering, are my kids being accepted where they are right now? Are they safe from prejudice and from stares and opinions and hate? But they have to. You know, that's us as a people. We were taught to just, you wake up and you go to work and you give it your all and you come home. And you take care of your family, and you just do it all over again. I can't focus. And I think that's why it was so hard to show up to work, because I'm expected to just shrug it off and be okay with it. The way that people say it, it just kind of sounds like your favorite sports team lost, you know, it's not okay to bring that to work, and it's not like that for me. It's reality. It's every memory of being mistreated because of my skin. It's hard to just shake it off and study for the quiz that I have today and do my job. It's really hard.
Selena Torres Medrano spoke with correspondent Anna King on KUOW Seattle, and the record continues in just a moment. This is KUOW's The Record. Congratulations to @RealDonaldTrump. I, for one, give him my most open mind and wish him great success in his service to the country. That is what Amazon CEO and Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos tweeted this morning. It's the first friendly gesture after an election season in which Bezos offered to launch Trump to the moon. Trump had threatened higher taxes for Amazon and banned Washington Post reporters from his campaign events. GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop follows Amazon's fortunes. Todd, will you give us the background here? Why the Trump-Amazon bad blood?
It started, it seems, with the Washington Post's tough but from the outside, fair reporting on Donald Trump. In a series of stories, the Post examined the candidate Trump, and Trump was not happy with that. And then during a series of appearances, Trump drew connections between Jeff Bezos and the Post. And obviously, Jeff Bezos owns the Post.
But, not Amazon, but Bezos
right,
personally.
Bezos personally. But Trump alleged that Bezos purchased the Post for the purpose of political influence, for the primary reason of keeping lawmakers away from Amazon in terms of taxes, antitrust, and
meaning what? The Post would use its editorial voice to tell me how that goes.
If a legislator is considering a piece of legislation that might impact Amazon negatively and Amazon's lobbyists are lobbying against it, they might say, well, what would the Washington Post do on this the front? And, you know, Jeff Bezos could wield his influence to influence public opinion about perhaps the lead author of that legislation. I mean, that's just one very practical impact.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, Trump alleges that Bezos primarily owns the Post for clout, which, of course, Jeff Bezos disputes. In a lot of ways, he, I think, looked at the Post acquisition as a chance to innovate in a new area, a chance to provide back to the world through perhaps keeping journalism alive and helping the Post leaders find a new economic model.
Is there any evidence that Bezos has been using the Post to trump at Amazon or be political in some way that's special from other papers?
It doesn't seem so. It seems that the Post is, you know, obviously they've been aggressive in their coverage of Trump, but at the same time, so have many other publications. That said, there was a call him out from the Washington Post, one of their commentators today, saying that, you know, journalists need to, you know, get their backbones straight now and really be strong against a Trump administration in terms of objective reporting on it.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in general, Trump has talked about being more aggressive against, like, allowing for lawsuits against journalists whose coverage he doesn't like. There's a big history here.
Absolutely. And if you look at the impact of the Trump administration, the potential impact on Amazon, it actually gets really interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Amazon's a big job creator. What is at stake for Amazon in Seattle in this feud?
The biggest thing right now is Trump's policies on trade and tariffs. If you think about Amazon as a business and all the stuff that is sold in the Everything Store, also known as Amazon.com, they are importing huge amounts of products. And if Trump, in an act of protectionism, puts tariffs on those products coming in, that could have a devastating, potentially, impact on Amazon's business.
And that's separate from any personal feud. That's just a matter of Trump's trade policies might not be good for Amazon.
Absolutely. That would be something that Amazon would be somewhat fearful of, I would imagine. And I think that's part, it's potentially part of what the overall picture that is making Jeff Bezos be somewhat pragmatic in that tweet this morning, which, you know, you've seen a lot of tech leaders do the same thing, where it's like, well, okay, we got to deal with this guy, so let's make the best of it.
What kind of response has Bezos been getting from other tech people and others online?
Since his tweet was largely in line with what other tech leaders have been doing, Tim Cook, Microsoft, all those folks, it seems like he's getting a bit of a pass in terms of acknowledging that you know, it is a Trump presidency. I mean, Hillary Clinton said, hey, we've got to work with this person. Barack Obama, the same thing.
Right.
So it's very much along those lines.
Any more thoughts on any Seattle economy ripple effect?
Well, the other question is antitrust. And if Trump goes after Bezos and Amazon on the issue of antitrust, you know, that is something that could dampen their business if suddenly Amazon's market power is questioned, and the question of whether they're unfairly or illegally wielding that market power, which is the heart of antitrust issues. You know, you look at what happened to Microsoft. Microsoft was gone after by the U.S. government, and, you know, right, whether or not you can trace it back as a direct cause and effect relationship, Microsoft struggled in those following years. And so if the government goes after Amazon in a similar way, you could see long term that having an impact on Amazon's growth.
How strong is the antitrust argument in the case of Amazon's power?
So it's not enough for a company to have a monopoly. They have to be abusing that monopoly to have antitrust charges against them.
Using it to control prices favorable to them?
Prices, or to move into adjacent markets and do that in an unfair way where they're using their clout in the other market, their clout in the other market to get into that. It's a complicated and tough case. I think Trump has a lot of other things on his plate. I mean, he's got to build the wall first, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, it's interesting because otherwise you would look at a Republican administration and say, hey, oh, they're going to be somewhat lax. And in part, you've seen some biotech stocks do better because of the potentially more relaxed regulatory environment following the Trump win. And so it's this weird cocktail of Republican philosophy and personal interests. And then you get into the tax issue with Amazon, and, you know, Trump is questioning whether they're paying enough taxes. And
yes,
that's kind of the height of irony at that
yes.
point from someone who clearly worked the system to minimize his taxes or potentially not pay any over a period of a couple decades. So I think the biggest risk here is the complete wild card and the difference between Trump the candidate and Trump the president. And the question is, what can he actually accomplish in office?
And what will he make his priorities? It's hard
exactly.
to tell. Finally, we have a minute left or so. What else in the tech world are you watching in relation to the president-elect? Anything we didn't cover?
Well, I'm actually fascinated with the backlash against social media on this whole issue and Facebook's algorithm and the question of whether the echo chamber, the bubble that many of us were in, was exacerbated by the fact that Facebook shows you things that you like just by its nature. That is what their algorithm does. And my big question going forward will be, are companies going to start looking at that artificial intelligence and a lot of those algorithms that are presenting information to us and say, hey, is there a better way to do this? Can we do something that will avoid essentially reassuring people about their views? Because when you're reassured about your views, you don't see the rest of the world and you're not spurred into action.
Let's do an entire interview just about that. That's
Absolutely.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking with Todd Bishop, co-founder of GeekWire, who joins us regularly, and we're glad of it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. You know, being transgender is not so mysterious or shocking to many Americans as it once was. Many people know about former Olympic champion Caitlyn Jenner or actress Laverne Cox, but there was a time when the world was far less aware. The podcast called How to Be a Girl features Marlo Mack, a single mom of a trans daughter. And in this excerpt from her podcast, Marlo asks an older transgender friend how things have and have not changed.
When I started writing my blog and producing this podcast, my daughter was just 5 years old.
Isn't this a beautiful necklace?
It is beautiful.
She had already told me that she was a girl.
No, it's a necklace crown.
But she couldn't tell me much else.
A necklace crown is like
what it felt like, what it meant to her.
Want to see how it looks?
I do.
Or what she needed from me, because she was five.
My little baby!
My own daughter was the first transgender person I ever met.
She just is so pretty.
This was before anyone was talking about people like Laverne Cox or Caitlyn Jenner.
She really loves you.
All I had heard were awful stories and frightening statistics. And it was hard to imagine any kind of a future for my child, let alone a bright one. And then, a few months after I started my blog, I got an email from a woman. We'll call her Lauren. She was in her 60s. She was about to retire after a long career working for the federal government. She had a long-term partner. She owned her own home. She was happy. And she was transgender. We started writing long emails back and forth. She told me about her life. And I wrote to her about my daughter and about my fears for her, looking for reassurance that things were going to be okay. After a year of emails, I asked her if we could meet in person.
So can we sort of kind of go back to the beginning and maybe talk about when you were a little child?
Sure. I was born in 1951, and I would say sometime around the age of 4 years old, I knew that there was something a little different about me, and I certainly did not feel like a boy. I didn't know what name to put to it, but I knew that it was, that's the way I felt. I can't tell you how many times I went upstairs and slipped on my mom's high heels when I was younger. I can't tell you how many times I would see my sister get dressed up and just yearn. It's terribly frustrating, terribly depressing.
The child's different from other children. He always was.
By the time I was 19,
now, Lauren,
and
he needs help
in college at the University of Nebraska,
maybe we should speak to the doctor.
I had the opportunity to see a what is now accepted as a very terrible B movie. It was called The Christine Jorgensen Story.
George, what are you doing in your sister's clothes? And my lipstick.
It was a story about a young man.
Are you trying to tell me you have a
who
sexual problem?
Was in World War II, fought.
I've always felt that
in the military.
My instincts and all my impulses are female.
And when he got out, he went to Denmark.
You're a woman trapped in the body of a man.
And while in Denmark, had a...
Is there anything that can be done for me?
Sex change operation. That's what they called it, a sex change operation.
In our country, no.
And came back to the United States, I think, in 1953 as what they called a blonde bombshell.
Christine Jorgensen, who used to answer to George, creates quite a stir as she returns home to New York from Copenhagen.
And
this is a true story.
This is a true story.
So there was a dramatization.
George Jorgensen, she took the name Christine Jorgensen.
That transformed her from a boy into a girl.
So you're sitting in this movie theater saying,
Eureka, that's me.
The podcast How to Be a Girl is a collaboration between KUOW and independent producer Seattle's Marlo Mack. And you can find out more about the podcast and how to subscribe at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. At the White House today, President-elect Donald Trump and President Obama met to discuss the peaceful and cooperative transfer of power. Obama called the 90-minute meeting excellent. Trump said he looks forward to receiving advice from his predecessor. Here in Washington State, Trump got just 38% of the vote. Knute Berger wrote about spending election night trying to square those two things, how the nation went red as Washington State stayed resolutely blue. Knute Berger, the Moss back at Crosscut, welcome back.
Glad to be here. I'm glad to have uncurled from the fetal position and actually...
Well, let's talk about that.
Somewhere.
Let's talk about that, Knute. I read your column, and it starts like this. For liberal progressives in the Pacific Northwest, this election is the clang of the ship of state hitting an iceberg named Donald Trump. You say this is a disaster. But by the end of the article, you say the Northwest and America in general are resilient. Okay, Titanic, resilient. I don't put those things together, so explain.
Well, it's sort of a process of trying to find hope amid what I think of as a kind of an electoral catastrophe. And, you know, in a way, we're insulated from some of the effects of it, at least on an interim basis. We're kind of...
We the Northwest?
We the Northwest, we the West Coast, we Washington State. We're zagging while the rest of the nation was zigging. We have a liberal Democrat we reelected as governor. We have, you know, some of the most liberal senators. We pass sound transit. We positive in terms of taxing ourselves to build infrastructure. We have a new gun law. We passed statewide minimum wage law. So, you know, we're still that progressive Northwest. But I think the election then raises these huge challenges, which are both national and regional, which is how can we kind of continue on that progressive path given the kinds of campaign promises and pledges that Donald Trump has made.
Examples, please.
Well, we know that he has less of a free trade-oriented policy, so that's a concern. Washington
is that a concern for the big Boeings?
Yes, now, it is. He's been highly critical of Boeing doing assembly work in China.
But the average voter seems to perceive that the little guy is going to benefit from renegotiating these trade deals.
Well, yeah, and I think there are places where that might be true to some extent. There are other places where I think he's been kind of selling a myth. If you look at how Donald Trump did in Washington State, the counties that he carried are almost directly correlated to unemployment in those counties. The high unemployment counties voted for Trump, the prosperous, mostly Puget Sound, but some on the Olympic Peninsula, and even one county in eastern Washington. Those they tend to be the lower unemployment counties, so there's a prosperity difference there that I think is a real issue, and I think here you have the tech people and Boeing concerned about policies that might restrict them or restrict trade, crack down on that. But, those steel jobs or timber jobs, resource jobs, agricultural jobs, a lot of those have gone away because of more systemic issues.
Knut, I love to talk with you because you have a long view. You're a scholar, in a way, of Northwest history and history in general. Based on your long view and your liberal politics, what do you think listeners ought to do?
I think the challenge is to keep our progressiveness, our regional progressiveness, and our regional values intact in a time when they're going to be challenged.
How would that happen?
Well, you know, I think that we've already done that to some degree. If you look at the Western states, we have liberal Democrats as governors. We're willing to tax ourselves for social benefit. We're willing to look at gun control. We're willing to look at... So we need to keep that going. One of the challenges is going to be that we're largely a creation of federal policy. Large amounts of public lands, large defense spending. We're reliant on federal trade policies. We're reliant on federal grants for infrastructure and for housing and dealing with the homeless.
Mayor Murray said, well, it looks like he didn't say for sure a homelessness levy in Seattle, but he's pretty much given up on more federal funding.
Yeah, we've been in a kind of go it alone phase increasingly over the last, really since the 1980s, really since the sort of federal gravy train stopped. And fortunately, with things like the tech boom, we found economic prosperity that wasn't necessarily reliant on federal subsidy. But that doesn't mean that those subsidies or lack of those subsidies have made it easy for us. And we have to pay more and more out of our own pocketbook. We can't necessarily rely on. When Donald Trump talks about boosting infrastructure, one of the keys to his plan, is, at least as I understand it, is essentially a plan that would privatize a lot of infrastructure, which people have done, where essentially you basically give the rights to build roads to private companies that then get to charge tolls on those roads, that kind of thing. So I think that we're going to face a lot of challenges depending on what is Congress and Trump actually decide to do.
Okay, we're going to watch all this actually happen together, Knut. But any final words for today?
Well, I'll tell you where I find hope. I find hope in the fact that the people that moved to the Pacific Northwest, first of all, they weren't necessarily immigrants, but they were internal migrants. Basically, they were people who fled what was happening in other parts of America because they didn't like it, and they came here to do better.
Utopians, you said.
Yes, exactly. We have a very strong, long history of idealists and utopians. They don't always agree. Sometimes they're diametrically opposed, but they come here, and we offer an opportunity for experimentation. We offer innovation. We offer an opportunity for people to do things differently. And I think we need to focus on that. I think that's a place where we can put positive energy, is embracing that tradition of going our own way. Now, does that mean actual Cascadian secession? I'm not there. But there is a kind of psychological secession, I think, that can be a positive in terms of coping with some of the things I think are coming down the line.
Right. This part of the land is our land.
Yeah, exactly.
That's Crosscut's chief Northwest native, the Mossback Canute Berger. And we're tweeting out a link to his post-election article right now at KUOW. So as you just heard, some Seattle progressives are finding a Trump presidency hard to swallow. Writer Ijeoma Oluo is thinking about her family.
You know, honestly, the first thing I wanted to do is get home to my kids. I was at an event, an election event with people, and I just needed to get home to my kids because I was thinking someone has to explain to them what just happened here. I had purposefully not told them that this was in the bag, like so many people were saying, because I didn't want to have to explain why I was so wrong. But I really wanted to explain to them the world that they now realize that they lived in. It was a profound sadness for me. It was not.
How did you explain it to them?
You know, what I explained to my youngest, especially my 9-year-old, was that we live in a world where people make a lot of decisions out of fear and a lot of decisions out of anger. And they don't make a lot of sense sometimes, especially to people like him, who haven't had to face all of that and haven't had to face a lot of the lies out there and haven't spent their whole lives being indoctrinated by it. But I told him to focus on his classmates and what they're believing right now and what they think and their priorities, and know that, you know, he's going to have a turn to do better, and they will do better, and his peers will do better. And he felt so betrayed. He felt so sad. He felt really scared. And I said, you know, when you talk to your class about this election, what did they think? And, you know, he said, none of them would have voted for Trump. None of them would have voted for this. They all want people to be safe here. They want equality. And, you know, they don't want any of this. And I said, okay, well, you know, in a couple of years, you're going to be the one who gets to make that choice. And you're going to make the right choice, and your peers are going to make the right choice. And I'm sorry we made this harder for you right now, you know, but I'm going to keep you safe. And I had to keep reminding him that, you know, that I've kept him safe so far. And a lot of what we're seeing now has been in place a long time. But, you know, I'm his mom, and I've been fighting for him, and I've been fighting for myself, and I was going to keep doing that, and we were going to get through it.
Other than talking to your children, now, what are you focused on doing?
You know, right now, what I'm focused on doing is I'm focused on capitalizing on all of the attention that America is finally paying right now. You know, I had so many people reaching out to me last night and this morning saying, what happened? What happened? What happened? And I really wanted to say, have you been reading my work? Have you been reading the work of so many other people who have been talking about this, who have been warning about this, who have been saying this actually is the society we live in? What I want to do now is I don't want to yell at other people. I don't want to be angry. What I want to do is I want to focus all of this energy, all of this attention toward the future. I want to focus on making ourselves as strong as possible in these next couple of months, because we are going to need unity. We are going to need our strength. We are going to need our focus come January. And that's what I want. I want to capitalize on this, because it's not going to be as bad as we think it is immediately. And then it may very well be as bad as we think it is eventually. And if we get complacent once this initial shock wears off, we're going to be asking ourselves, how did this happen again in a couple more years? And now is a time to focus this energy and make sure that we know how this happened and what we can do to ensure it doesn't happen again.
Are you just talking about unity among progressives? Are you thinking about unity across a divide in this country?
I'm talking about both, and immediately I'm talking about unity across progressives. And I think that that's important because I think that even when you look at the numbers, there were huge gaps there, right, where we could have come together. But also, I think that the majority, especially of white America, has access to conservatives in their family, in their offices, in their community, people who care about them, care about their emotions and care about how they're feeling. And a lot of us were afraid, a lot of people were afraid to have those difficult conversations leading up to this. We wanted to keep the peace and not say, hey, this is the real effect that you're going to have on me. Well, here we are. And so now is a really good time to start having those tough conversations. We have nothing to lose now. We can start having these conversations. We can start pushing buttons. We can start saying, you know, what are you going to do to be here for me? I am afraid and I am upset and I am hurt and I feel betrayed and I need your help. If you care about me, regardless of you, you know, people have been saying all of this time that it's just politics. It's just politics. Well, now we have the real life effects. And so, you know, if your family members are hurting, you're community members are hurting, now is a good time to start having those conversations.
What's one thing you'll take away from this election?
One thing I will definitely take away from this election is I think how much we wanted to deceive ourselves and how hard we will work at that.
Why is that important to you?
I think it's important because I think that's our number one enemy.
You know? Self-deception.
It really is. This is the world we've been living in, and we've been looking at these rallies. We've been making so many excuses this entire election season, right? Every rally that was brimming with anger and hate, right? When we watched people of color being pushed to the ground and being hit and being spat upon, when we saw all of this anti-immigrant sentiment, and we saw crowds of thousands of people cheering it on, we made excuses every time because we didn't want to admit that this is how our friends and our neighbors and our community members actually feel. And that is what defeated us. That is what did it. Because in that complacency, we let people slide. We let people justify to themselves really abhorrent decisions. And I really do think that's where we lost this.
You and I have talked about this before, that you're not necessarily saying that most of those Trump voters think of themselves as bigoted.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
So what do you see going on?
You know, I think one of the funny things about bigotry, one of the funny things about white supremacy in America is that it doesn't require your intention. It is something that works at a default. And I don't think we realize that we are born into it, that it is a legacy handed down to us. And a lot of what we have that makes us comfortable as people is rooted in that. Our status, our identity, our jobs, our property, our neighborhoods are all rooted in that. And when things threaten that, right? And a black president will threaten that. Marriage equality will threaten that. A female candidate will threaten that. Increases in immigration will threaten that. We feel
losing your job or seeing your wages flatten.
Exactly.
Might threaten that too.
It will threaten that, especially if you see other groups that you are used to seeing make less than you doing better, right? That threatens not only your security, but also your sense of identity, because we oftentimes view ourselves in comparison to other groups. All of these things that threaten that, you feel uncomfortable and you don't have a name for it. And you don't have immediate malice on the surface. All you know is that you want to get things back to the way they were. The end result, though, is oppression. The end result is more white supremacy, right? The end result is more patriarchy. And it does not care what your intentions are. And I think that we need to look at that. We weren't investigating these emotions. There were all these think pieces saying, no, middle America is just scared. They're just scared. But we never said, what's the root of that fear? And is it legitimate, right? Do we have a right to be this afraid of change that is actually improving the lives for so many people? We always just assumed that it was valid. And it wasn't, because it's been built on a system of injustice. And the fear has been equality. The fear has been justice that erodes the platform that so many people have built their lives upon.
So if that animating emotion is not malice, but it's fear, which we can all relate to, do you think that progressives and Trump supporters have a way forward together in this country?
I hope so. And I think it'll be hard. I think this is one of those things that is a massive, it's a massive retraining almost. It actually reminds me of the old spotted owl debate that we had in the 90s, where we were like, oh, don't worry, don't log anymore. We will retrain you. You'll have a new job. And people were saying, are you kidding me? This is my life. My grandparents did this. My father did this. I was born to do this. This is my life. And you can't just come in and say, here's the new world. But the truth is that we have grown in two separate worlds. We have a world that has moved towards equality, that has moved, you know, towards justice. And we have a world that is still very stuck on a hierarchy. And to say suddenly you need to accept this new world when we haven't done any of the retraining, we haven't looked at how we are educating our children on this. We haven't looked at the way in which our entire justice system is set up around this, the way our government set up around this, our entire world's built upon it. So in a day, you can't say, vote for something different. We actually have to start at the beginning. And I think that's the only way forward, because in all honesty, people need the tools to move forward. We grew up here, those of us who grew up here in the Northwest or in liberal areas like this, we forget that we were born with a different expectation, right? Now, we do still have some very white supremacist expectations here, but we also had, you know, different expectations as to what being a man is, as to what being a white person is. And we had our entire lives to acclimate to that. And so as change comes along, it kind of fits into the mold that we have grown up in. And we really need to start looking at this, how we are talking about this, how it is in our culture, in our films. Because what we had was we had Trump wrapping up in a bow the ultra-typical stereotype of white American males. And for people who were raised to think that that's what they should expect, this was home and this was comfort for them. And that's what we need to start attacking. And I think that if we can do that and we can start people young and we can start early in our systems, that's where we can really move forward together.
Talking about what we can do, that's Ijeoma Oluo, who wrote a piece for The Stranger called Good Morning America, Welcome to Your White Supremacy. We're tweeting out a link to that now at KUOW. Are you hopeful about a Trump presidency? We'd like to hear from you. How do you expect your life will improve under this government? Does it come at somebody else's expense? Our email address is record@kuow.org. And our phone number is 206-221-3663. That's 221-3663. It's KUOW's The Record. 2 days after the election, you have some happy populists, you have some Americans protesting in cities, including Seattle, and KUOW listeners are suggesting things we can do to support each other, like this idea.
Hi, Bill. This is Shannon Smith from Federal Way. I know people are hurting, and I want them, when they see me, to know that I support them and love them. And I'm hoping that NPR will help come up with some symbol that people can wear every day that will communicate that. So if someone is hurting, they can see me and know that I have their back.
Wear your support on your sleeve. That's an interesting idea. I wonder what that symbol could be. Now, here's some advice for action that's a little more internal.
Hi there, this is Kate, and I'm calling from Des Moines, Washington. It's important to have an open mind, and we also shouldn't expect things of our leaders that we are not willing to do. So if we want hate to go away, if we want anger and mistrust and divisiveness to go away, we need to stop doing that in our day-to-day life. So we can't think about them versus us. Us, we are one. We're all humans. We're all people. And we seem to forget that sometimes when we are all entitled to our opinions. That's the nature of being human and being an individual. Everyone has a right to their opinions, but if we use those differences to divide ourselves, then we're not doing the best thing that we can with that knowledge.
Practice your own open-mindedness. What about you? What are you planning to do now that the election's over? Email your thoughts to record@KUOW or talk to us on Facebook and Twitter. On Twitter, we are @KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in today. You know, the last time we talked to our Canadian friend, Vaughn Palmer, at the Vancouver Sun, he said his country was fascinated by our upcoming elections. Vaughn, what's Canada saying about President-elect Trump?
Well, we're kind of shocked, along with everybody else. We took your guy's word for it that Clinton had it in the bag, so
yeah.
We're blaming it on you for the big news. Our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, did the gracious foreign leader look forward to working with you statement, and most of our other government leaders, to the degree they've commented, have said the same thing. We're kind of apprehensive, Bill. I told you that Canada's got a bunch of trade issues with the United States anyway, and we're thinking we were in for a pretty rough ride with Clinton on the trade file.
Mm-hmm.
Goes without saying that Trump is not going to be an easier sell, so there's a fair amount of apprehension up here. One little bit of good news, I guess, for some Canadians anyway, province of Alberta, which has most of our oil, is busy recalling today that Trump promised to bring back the Keystone Pipeline.
So right.
If that happens, Alberta will be able to get its oil south to Texas and Louisiana and maybe start selling more of it. So this is an odd one, but there's been some thought of why would we need to build a pipeline out to Vancouver if the Keystone is going to go ahead? Maybe we can just ship the oil to the United States and not worry about bringing it to the West Coast.
Right. Put those oil tankers in American ports instead of Canadian ones. Is the Prime Minister Trudeau pro Keystone XL?
Yeah, he actually thought it was a great idea, so that's a good one.
Okay.
And now, you know, there's a long list of issues on which Trudeau and Trump are not likely to see eye to eye. There's a very funny cartoon this morning in the Globe and Mail newspaper, Brian Gable, one of our funniest political cartoonists. So Trudeau's big slogan is Sunny Ways, and he got along really well with Obama. So there's Trudeau walking into the Oval Office, and sitting behind the desk with a big T on his helmet is Darth Vader, surrounded by a couple of, soldiers. From Star Wars, and one of them is saying, this is going to be interesting. So,
what about
those?
There's
a lot of stereotyping up here
well.
So,
yes.
But Trump's used to that, I think.
What about those differences? You want to pick out one that's going to be a clash?
Climate action.
Yeah.
Trudeau was very, very enthusiastic, in spite of the oil thing, about climate action, carbon pricing up here in Canada, signing on to the Paris Accord. That's not great news for Trudeau. Canada, of course, is very enthusiastic about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, about international trade agreements of any kind, NAFTA. And again, Trump is no friend on that, so there'll be plenty of room for disagreement over the next few years. Trudeau was attuned to Obama on a whole bunch of issues, and I think, could have worked with Clinton on a lot of things. It's a big unknown with Trump.
A lot of big unknowns. I heard Canada's immigration website crashed on Tuesday evening because of volume.
So we've talked about this over the years, and, every time there's a Republican gets elected president of the United States, Canadians hear talk from their American friends about coming up here. We generally go, you're not serious, right? And I don't know if Americans are serious about it or not, but yeah, the Canadian government immigration website where you can go on and find out how to immigrate to Canada crashed briefly on Tuesday night. It's not as easy as people think. Canada has immigration laws and quotas, and you have to qualify to get in, and there are a lot of people from around the world trying to come to Canada. So giving up your American citizenship and coming here isn't as easy as people think. I think when Americans sit down and reflect on it, they tend not to leave their country just because they don't much like the current president. If they did, we would have had a lot of people come up here under both Bushes and Ronald Reagan, and that didn't happen.
That's true. Yes, it's not easy. You'd need a job, a work visa, or I guess a student visa. And if you overstayed your visa, what does Canada do to undocumented immigrants?
We'll ship them back.
Oh.
You can apply for refugee status, obviously, and that gives you some protections. But
to stand Donald Trump will not qualify you for refugee status.
Another great political cartoon in Canadian history was the first time the separatists won the election in Quebec. 40 years ago, there was a great cartoon ran in a Canadian newspaper. It was the separatist leader, and he was saying, okay, everybody take a Valium. Like, relax,
mm-hmm.
Don't assume what's going to happen. just relax and let the train of events play itself out. And that's probably a good idea for both countries in the moment, I think, don't you?
Well, that's a conversation. When do you let events play out, or when do you decide, oh, maybe it is time to try to oppose events? That we're having exactly that discussion right here, Vaughn.
Well, we're in a democracy. We still got free speech. I looked at all those demonstrations last night, and I thought people are really behaving themselves, you know, and that's a good thing. My sense, watching American politics since 1968, is that the country is pretty resilient. It generally finds its equilibrium. And I would argue, from all my knowledge of American history, going right back to the beginning, the United States has survived worse, in my opinion, so we shall see.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Thanks a lot, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And as Vaughn said, you are unlikely to actually move to Canada, but I tell you what, if you really are moving, and I don't mean you checked a website, but I mean, like, you're doing this, we would like to hear from you. Our address is record@kuow.org. You know, some people say if you want America to be different, stay and make it different. So what do you make of that? Record@kuow.org. Our phone number, 206-221-3663. 221-3663. We're on Twitter @KUOW. We're on Facebook, and we're glad you've tuned in today. I'm Bill Radke.